Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi there again, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm looking mainly at the challenges that the British Royal Navy had in the Mediterranean during the Second World War. Looking again at Max Hastings tonight, and the difficulties firstly caused by some of the venerable age of Royal Naval warships. Obviously Britain had the largest navy in the world in 1939. It didn't necessarily mean that much of the Royal Naval tonnage was up to date. Secondly, as is so often the case with Britain's war, Churchill's strategy caused huge complications for the Royal Navy, particularly Britain's decision to wage a war in North Africa, and for Churchill to make this part of the major effort of the British war from 1939 to about 1943. This caused a huge overstretch in the Mediterranean and vulnerability. Anyway, Max Hastings writes, "Most British battleships were old and slow and could not be adapted for bulky modern fire-controlled equipment. The Dutch Navy's triaxially stabilised Hasmeyer system represented the most advanced AA gunnery technology in the world, to which the Royal Navy gained access in 1940. It was fragile and unreliable, however, and the British version entered general service only in 1945. Anti-aircraft fire control remained sadly ineffective meanwhile. Britain had more carriers than the US Navy in 1943, but they were never enough to go round, or rather to meet global demand, and they were too small to carry powerful air groups. Fleet air arm pilots displayed notable courage, but their performance was indifferent in both air combat and anti-shipping operations. The RAF, doctrinally committed to a strategic bomber offensive, resisted the diversion of resources to support operations at sea. Throughout the conflict, the Royal Navy displayed the highest standards of courage, commitment and seamanship, but until 1943, it struggled against odds to fulfil too many responsibilities with too few ships, all vulnerable to air attack. An example of that, of course, is the sinking of the Repulse and the Prince of Wales off the coast of Malaya in 1942. Once again, vulnerable to air attack, and with a very, very loose fighter screen from Malaya, the sitting ducks really for the Japanese that had known about the arrival of these two warships, and because of Churchill announcing that they would be sent to protect Singapore and Malaya. And of course, knowing that they were coming, the Japanese practiced dive bombing against warships just in time for them to turn up. Churchill's decision to make a major British military effort in North Africa obliged the Navy to conduct operations in the Mediterranean with negligible air cover. And in the face of strong Axis air forces operating from fields in Italy, Sicily, Libya, Rhodes, Greece and Crete, able seaman Charles Hutchinson described an attack on the cruiser Carlisle in May 1941. The bombers came and attacked us wave after wave. They seemed to single a ship out and deliver a mass attack on it, diving vertically from all angles. A huge bomb exploded in the water near our gun. Tons of water crashed down on us, tearing us away from the gun and tossing us around like straw. I was certain we would be swept over the side. One thought flashed in my mind. My God, this is the end. After what seemed an eternity, we picked ourselves up, blew up our life belts and kicked away our shoes, as I for one expected to abandon ship. But in short time, we were firing again, as we were still being attacked. Huge pieces of shrapnel lay around. There was a huge column of black smoke amidships and a direct hit on number two gun. There isn't a gun now, just a piece of charred metal. Nearly all the gun's crew were wiped out. Most of the lads trapped underneath the gun or blown away like against the splinter shield. It was a ghastly sight. We lived and slept all as a family for a year and a half, laughed, quarrelled and joked, all gone ashore together, discussed our private lives. Poor old Bob Silvey is still under the gun. I've seen him, but it's impossible to get him out. Part of the problem of campaigning in North Africa for the British and the German armies, and the Italians as well, was the distances involved, and the fact that the longer the more territory the one or other army conquered, the longer the supply lines became, and the more thirsty the army became for both drinking water and fuel. And the problem, therefore, was resupply. And by late 1942, the German successes across North Africa that end with the Second Battle of El Alamein and the torch landings in Tunisia and Algeria mean that the German campaign of the Africa Corps is thrown into crisis. But it's also thrown into crisis because supplies are not coming across the Mediterranean. Despite the problems of the Royal Navy that we've just heard about there, by late 1942, the Royal Navy and the RAF are causing havoc for the Axis powers in the Mediterranean. So there was some really kind of radical changes of fortune in the Mediterranean, which spelled doom ultimately for the North Africa campaign. And a lot of this is related to the island of Malta. So Max Hastings writes, Malta, the only offshore outpost in the central Mediterranean from which the Axis supply routes to North Africa could be interdicted, it faced 3 years of siege. under almost continuous bombardment from nearby Sicily. At times, the island became unserviceable as an offensive base for submarines and surface ships, but it remained a vital earnest of Britain's will to fight. Hitler blundered by failing to seize Malta in 1941, and huge efforts and sacrifices were made to sustain it thereafter. Between June 1940 and early 1943, the Mediterranean was largely unusable as an Allied supply route. But Churchillian war-making emphasised assertion of the Navy's presence and engagements of opportunity, especially against the Italian fleet. Some of the fiercest naval fighting of the war and heavy British losses took place in those limpid waters. The Axis faced increasing pressure on its own sealing to North Africa, but the passage between southern Italy and Tripoli was short. Only in mid-1942 did shipping losses and fuel shortages begin to exert an important influence on Rommel's fortunes. So here we switch to Anthony Beaver and his history of the Second World War, which I guess, I mean, for my money is probably the better book and something that I really will delve more into in a distant future, actually. But we're going to look now at his views on the resupply of Rommel's armies across the Mediterranean. And here in his chapter on June to December 1941, he writes, "Soon after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Rommel had begun to plan a new attack on the besieged port of Tobruk, which had become the key to the war in North Africa. He needed it to supply his troops and to eliminate the threat to his rear. Tobruk was now held by the British 70th Division, reinforced by a Polish brigade and a Czech battalion. During the desert summer, with its mirage shimmer on the desert under a blazing sky, a sort of phony war had developed, with little more than the odd skirmish along the wire of the Libyan frontier. British and German reconnaissance patrols chattered to each other by radio, on one occasion complaining when a newly arrived German officer forced his men to open fire after a tacit ceasefire had been arranged. For the infantry on both sides, life was less amusing under such conditions, with just a litre of water a day for drinking and washing. In their trenches, they had to cope with scorpions, sand fleas and aggressive desert flies, which swarmed over every piece of food and every inch of exposed flesh. Dysentery became a major problem, especially for the Germans. Even the defenders of Tobruk were short of water, as a Stuka attack had wrecked the desalination plant. The town itself was badly battered by shell fire and bombing, and the harbour half full of sunken ships. Only the determination of the Royal Navy kept them supplied. Members of the remaining Australian Brigade began bartering war loot for beer as soon as the ship arrived. Rommel had a much greater problem of resupply across the Mediterranean. Between January and late August 1941, the British had managed to sink 52 Axis ships and damage another 38. In September, the submarine HMS Upholder sank two large passenger ships carrying reinforcements. Africa Corps veterans began to call the Mediterranean the German swimming pool. The Axis failure to invade Malta in 1940 was now shown to have been a major mistake. The Kriegsmarine especially had been dismayed earlier that in the year, and Hitler insisted that the airborne forces should be used against Crete rather than Malta, because he feared Allied raids against the Ploesti oil fields. Since then, the constant bombing of airfields on Malta and the Grand Harbour of Valletta had not proved an effective substitute for outright capture. This is a huge thing, I think, that gets kind of overlooked. When people talk about Hitler's fateful decisions, you know, the decision to stop the tanks at Dunkirk and allow the British Expeditionary Force to get away. Apocryphally, Hitler, in some magnanimous moment, decided that he would let the British go away to show good faith. And, of course, that's total nonsense. Hitler was quite intent on destroying the British Expeditionary Force. The halt order was really about allowing a break for the exhausted tank crews and the fact that the terrain wasn't really supportive of tank warfare. But mainly it was the fact that Goering had promised that the BEF could be destroyed from the air, and Hitler foolishly took Goering at his word. The other fateful decisions, the decisions to invade the Soviet Union, obviously, you know, fundamentally shaping not just the rest of the war, but really the rest of the 20th century. But the decision to not seize Malta eventually dooms the North African campaign. Aircraft can be flown from Malta to bomb German resupply convoys, and ships can sail from Malta, and submarines can sail from Malta too. And so Malta, in many ways, is a real failing. And the decision to seize Crete, possibly Crete would have been a more of an obstacle, but the oil fields at Ploiești in Romania are eventually bombed from Egypt anyway, by eventually in 1943 by the US Air Force. So it was a kind of quite a disaster. Also, British signals intelligence really comes into its own at this point. The war in the Mediterranean is very much one from Bletchley Park. British intercepts of Italian naval codes provided rich rewards. On the 9th of November, K-Force, sailing from Malta with the light cruisers HMS Aurora and Penelope, and two destroyers, struck a Tripoli-bound convoy.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Although the convoy was escorted by two heavy cruisers and 10 destroyers, the British force dashed in at night using radar. In less than 30 minutes, three Royal Naval warships sank all seven freighters and a destroyer without suffering any damage. The Kriegsmarine was livid and threatened to take over control of Italian naval operations. The Africa Corps adopted a similarly patronising view of its allies. "One has to treat the Italians like children," a lieutenant in the 15th Panzer Division wrote home. They are no good as soldiers, but they are the best comrades. You can get anything from them. After all the delays and waiting for supplies, which never came, Rommel planned his strike against Tobruk for the 21st of November. He disbelieved Italian warnings that the British were about to launch a major offensive, yet he felt compelled to leave the 21st Panzer Division behind Tobruk and Bardia, between Tobruk and Bardia, just in case. This would probably have left him with insufficient forces for a successful attack on Tobruk. In any case, on the 18th of November, 3 days before his planned assault on the port, the newly named British 8th Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Alan Cunningham, crossed the Libyan frontier and in Operation Crusader. Having made approach marches at night under strict radio silence and concealed by day with sandstorms and thunderstorms, the 8th Army achieved total surprise. So by early 1942, as the tide of war once again slipped away from the British and into Germany's favour the British were forced to retreat once more all the way across what is now Libya, and all the way eventually into Egypt, where they hold the line at El Alamein at the end of the year. And Anthony Beaver writes, after the humiliating retreat across Cyrenaica in January and February 1942, the Rommel myth, so fervently propagated by Goebbels, was also promoted by the British. The legend of the Desert Fox was a very misguided attempt to explain away their own failures. Hitler was amazed and delighted by such hero worship. It encouraged his belief that the British, after all their defeats in the Far East, were close to collapse. He was, however, prepared to rein in his favourite general to appease the Italians. Mussolini's position was threatened by the growing opposition within the Comando Supremo, whose members felt that the Duce was too much in Hitler's pocket, and they had been affronted by Rommel's arrogance and peremptory demands, to say nothing of his constant complaints about the failure to provide and protect the supply convoys he needed. In addition, Halder and the OKH were still resolutely opposed to reinforcing Rommel. They argued that the Suez Canal should be taken only after an advance through the Caucasus. Of course, the primacy of the Russian campaign would have been hugely, hugely important to them, and the ability to make the argument that the war could be run through the Russia campaign alone was utmost in their calculations. The priority of the Eastern Front remained a powerful argument as they prepared their great offensive in southern Russia. Only the Kriegsmarine, which wanted the policy of defeating Britain first, supported Rommel's ambitions. The island of Malta was in a desperate position after a renewed Luftwaffe bombing offensive against the airfields and the main harbour of Valletta. All five ships in a convoy in March were sunk, and the troops and civilian population faced starvation. But in May, a reinforcement of 60 Spitfires flown off the aircraft carrier USS Wasp and the arrival of a mine layer with supplies saved the island. General Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, the German commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean, had made plans for an airborne invasion of Malta, Operation Hercules. But these had to be put aside. Not only was Hitler dubious of success, but 10th Flieger Corps was needed further east. Also, the Italians demanded excessive support before committing themselves. Hitler had big reservations about airborne troops after Crete. Before the invasion of Crete, he'd been emphatic that this was one of the chief weapons of the German war machine. Following Crete, when hundreds of parachutists were shot in the air by British and New Zealand troops and Australian troops, the Führer's belief in the efficacy of airborne invasions kind of crumbled. Rommel himself was absolutely certain that he was absolutely certain of success, to the extent that he ignored Hitler he ignored Hitler's kind of uncharacteristic caution. The orders came through for a pause to allow supply lines to reach his army, to allow for resupply and for supply lines to kind of establish themselves. But once again, he moved forward. The fighting has none of the horror, that indescribable misery of the Russian campaign, an Unteroffizier wrote home in April. No villages and towns destroyed or laid to waste. In another letter that evening, he wrote to his mother, "The Tommy out here takes everything in a more sporting way, onwards to a decisive victory." Although Rommel's soldiers were also afflicted by the mass of flies and intense heat which baked their bread hard, they soon expected a victory from the great offensive in Russia, and the Tommies here will be crushed from both sides. they looked forward to visiting Cairo. The OKW then suddenly came round to the idea of Rommel's dream of seizing Egypt and the Suez Canal. Hitler began to fear that American military support might arrive earlier than he had originally thought. Even an Allied attack across the Channel could not be ruled out. If Rommel could smash the Eighth Army, he reasoned, British morale would be shattered. Also, the Japanese had indicated that they would advance westwards into the Indian Ocean only if the Germans took the Suez Canal. So now you can sort of see, to some onlookers, to some military historians, North Africa is a sideshow. And in terms of numbers, it is. In terms of troops committed, it is. But actually, by this point in the war, by early to mid-1942, there is a point to the North Africa campaign, and it's about breaking the British. It's about severing the British from their empire. It's about seizing the Suez Canal. It's less to do with oil. I'm absolutely certain of that. I believe Hitler's view about where oil was, it was Russia. I mean, of course, you know, nobody is unaware that oil is in the Middle East, but Hitler's the oil that Hitler wanted was in Russia. But it was also about breaking British morale, showing Britain that fighting on was hopeless, and that there would be and could be no final victory, and also galvanising Japan to raid into the Indian Ocean as far as Madagascar. The first stage of Rommel's invasion of Egypt, codenamed Operation Theseus, was to outflank the British defensive line. This extended in defended boxes from Gazala on the coast, some 80 kilometres west of Tobruk, south towards Bir Hakeim, an outpost in the desert defended by General Marie-Pierre Koenig's 1st Free French Brigade. There were seven boxes, each defended by an infantry brigade group with artillery, barbed wire and minefields, which extended down to the next box. To the rear, Ritchie had placed his armoured formations ready to make a counterattack. Rommel then intended to seize Tobruk. The capture of the port was regarded as essential for resupply. Otherwise, it would take his Opel Blitz trucks 14 days for each round trip up from Tobruk, Tripoli, all the way back again. So Tobruk was about making sure that the supplies could run smoothly. Tobruk does fall in the end. But ultimately, Rommel's supply lines become self-defeating. They become too long. And what Rommel is defeated by, not only by the massive American resupply of the British, but also by the logic of desert warfare itself and the fact that Malta remains a kind of a key vulnerability for German supplies, resupplies by sea, and the kind of the vulnerability that Hitler didn't deal with in 1940. Anyway, I hope you find this useful, and coming up after this podcast, there's the second of our Ukraine updates, which I hope you find useful and informative. Thanks very much. All the best, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.